Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
It's Thursday, the 5th of January. Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet, in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Wanjiko Mwaura with what's trending on social media today.
Coming up, as the Gambian's president-elect prepares for his inauguration on 19th January, apprehension continues to surround the country.
Look, there's fear, and everybody is fearful, and President Jammeh and his supporters are fearful.
German politicians continue to debate security after the attack on a Berlin Christmas market.
Yeah, the Interior Minister Thomas de Maizière thinks that Germany's security architecture is not fit for purpose. He says it's too devolved, like many other aspects of Germany's government. He wants to centralise it.
And we'll also be hearing your opinions on the situation in Gambia.
We'll be back shortly after hearing what's been happening around the world.
I'm Crispin Mwakideo with DW News. At least 14 people were killed on Thursday in a car bombing in Syria's coastal province of Latakia, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported. The attack, which took place near a stadium in the government-controlled town of Jable, comes amid further violations of a nationwide ceasefire, which went into effect last week. Meanwhile, the United Nations Special Advisor for Syria, Jan Egeland, say the UN is disappointed that they have been denied access to 5 of 21 locations in Syria, although the ceasefire is largely holding. In Turkey, an explosion near a courthouse in the city of Izmir has killed at least 2 people, a police source said. Turkish police responded by killing 2 of the suspected attackers and have launched a manhunt for a third suspect. Authorities blame Kurdish militants for the car bomb attack. Thursday's explosion follows a shooting in Istanbul in which 39 people celebrating New Year's Eve were killed inside a nightclub. The so-called Islamic State later claimed responsibility. Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg on Thursday said Britain lacks the experience in international negotiations and that this could slow down the Brexit talks. The talks, which could begin by the end of March, are expected to be some of the most complicated Britain has engaged in since World War II. Norwegian Prime Minister Solberg said the EU and Britain should hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
We do feel that sometimes when we are discussing with Britain that their speed is limited by the fact that it's such a long time since they have negotiated that type of treatment. I fear a very hard Brexit, but I hope we will find a solution that leaves Britain as a partner into a lot of the European activities that we need them to be in.
You are listening to DW News. The UN Security Council has issued a statement welcoming the signing of a comprehensive and inclusive political agreement in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Council President Ambassador Olof Skog of Sweden commended the efforts by the Congolese bishops who mediated the deal, but called on all parties to stick to the agreement.
Le Conseil compte que l'accord sera mis en œuvre.
The Security Council hopes for a swift implementation of the agreement in good faith and in all its components, in accordance with the Congolese Constitution and in line with Security Council Resolution 2277, in order to organize peaceful, credible, inclusive, and timely presidential, national, and provincial legislative elections no later than December 2017, leading to a peaceful transfer of power.
Une transmission pacifique de pouvoir.
Pakistan on Thursday freed more than 200 Indian fishermen who had strayed into its waters. Dozens of Indian and Pakistani fishermen are captured in the Arabian Sea each year after straying across maritime borders. Relations between the two nuclear-armed rivals have plummeted since a deadly attack on an Indian army base in the disputed region of Kashmir in September. Nigeria has resumed cash payments to former Niger Delta militants. Under a 2009 amnesty deal, each former militant is entitled to 65,000 naira, around $207, each month, plus job training. Buhari's government had cut the budget for cash payments to the militants to end corruption, but later resumed payments to stop pipeline attacks, crippling vital oil revenues. For more news and information, visit dw.com. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And Wanjiko Mwaura.
And we start the program from the Gambia, where the Army Chief, General Ousmane Beji, has pledged his unflinching loyalty to President Yahya Jammeh in a letter published in a pro-government newspaper. Earlier on, the same general had pledged support for the president-elect Adama Barrow. On Wednesday, I asked Khalifa Sala, leader of the opposition coalition in the Gambia, about General Beji's announcement, and this is what he had to say.
Outgoing President Jammeh is still the president of the republic, and one does not expect the security forces to simply go there and say, let them remove him from office. That will constitute a coup d'etat. What is anticipated is for them to fraternize with the population and wait for the 19th.
Khalifa Sala responding to General Beji's announcement. So what impact is this pledge of loyalty likely to have on any decision by ECOWAS to send troops to Gambia? I put this question to Alex Vines, head of the Africa program at Chatham House Research Institute in London.
The military, some of them are very insecure, particularly after one of the advisors, aides of President-elect Adama Barrow, suggested that they would prosecute within a year President Jammeh, and suggested that people around him might also be indexed. Now, the question is, as you've asked, what's going to happen now in terms of ECOWAS's calculations? ECOWAS, I think, will continue to focus on that there needs to be a peaceful transition of power on the 19th of January, which is the last day that President Jammeh is legitimately president of the Gambia.
What can you tell us about General Ousmane Beji? How much royalty does he inspire in his troops?
He has some support, but not whole support. And I think that's really the question here. If there were to be an ECOWAS intervention, which is a possible scenario now with military support, probably vanguarded by Senegal, one wonders how united the Gambian military would be. Let alone its ability to combat a ECOWAS disciplined force entering the country.
And why do you think he's chosen to voice support for Jammeh at this particular point in time?
Look, there's fear, and everybody is fearful, and President Jammeh and his supporters are fearful. So there is an issue here of how to build up trust and to provide a soft exit of this standoff, because Gambia can ill afford instability. Its economy is doing poorly. It really needs tourism. It needs investment.
Now, is there the political will and resolve for an ECOWAS military intervention if Jammeh clings to power? I mean, putting troops on alert is one thing, but ordering an invasion is something quite different, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, Senegal has been involved in the Gambia before militarily. That's not unique. The one thing that Jammeh has successfully done is he's united everybody against him. He has no friends, which is why this is a really difficult situation for him, you know, and the economic community of West African states is pretty united.
I was speaking to Alex Vines of Chatham House, London. Now, nearly 3 weeks since the Berlin attack, many questions remain unanswered. German authorities are now certain that Anis Amir was the man who carried out the December 19th attack at a Christmas market in Berlin. Among the many questions are how Amir was able to cross the many borders he did before he was killed in Italy, and why German authorities did not have him under surveillance even though he was listed as a threat. The latest person arrested in the ongoing investigations is a Tunisian man who is said to have had dinner with Amir the day before the attack. DW's political correspondent Simon Young spoke to Sumi Somaskanda about what is known about the latest arrest.
It seems this man was a known radical Salafist and an Islamist extremist as part of the scene in Berlin, if you like. He met Anis Amri the night before the attack. They had a meal together. But it seems the police might not know very much more than that, because, as you've also reported, he hasn't been arrested on charges directly related to the attack, instead on charges that he has been making fraudulent welfare claims. And this man has been arrested before. He was picked up in November 2015 when he was accused of planning a bomb attack in Dusseldorf with two other men, but there wasn't enough evidence and he was released at that time.
Simon, meanwhile, we're getting a broader picture of Amri himself. What other details have we found out?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some confirmation of Anis Amri, he was up to, really, in the months before the attack. He had clearly been seeking contacts among jihadists in Germany, asking people specifically to help him carry out an attack. And one interesting detail, it's reported that an undercover officer had reported that Anis Amri had been boasting to friends and contacts that he was going to cause a bloodbath. So plenty of clues, really, that this attack was going to happen.
Sam, the investigation is going on amid a broader debate about security in Germany, and the Interior Minister has proposed some changes. What are they and how are they being received?
Yeah, the Interior Minister, Thomas de Maizière, thinks that Germany's security architecture is not fit for purpose. He says it's too devolved, like many other aspects of Germany's government. He wants to centralise it. You know, he says that the individual lender, the regional states, have their own intelligence officials and, their own approaches to this. He wants to bring it under central government. But, of course, a change like that will take a long time to implement and has already met quite a lot of opposition. Some people are saying, just implement the laws that exist already, and that could actually have prevented an attack like this.
So Mesomas Kanda speaking to DW's political correspondent Simon Young. Now in Gabon, the mood remains gloomy just 10 days before they host the Africa Cup of Nations tournament. A political and economic crisis has deafened the spirit of football fans in Gabon as it puts its final touches on the four stadiums to host the matches. Selau Neko with the details.
Gabon boasts one of the best strikers in the German Football League, Dortmund's Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who was named Bundesliga Player of the Year 2016. But the small Central African state is yet to catch the football fever, with the African Cup of Nations slated to kick off on the 14th of this month. The locals have not completely been won over by the prospect of following their national team, the Panthers, and that despite lowering the ticket prices, which start at less than $1. Patrick Leomba from Gabon's AFCON organizing committee, however, remains hopeful.
It's early January, so we know we still have enough time to sell tickets and that the people will come.
Meanwhile, Gabon's political and economic crisis interrupted the game's preparations following the controversial re-election of President Ali Bongo Ondimba in August last year. Opposition leader Jean Ping says the elections were rigged and declared himself the rightful winner. Opposition newspapers have since made calls to boycott the African Cup of Nations or to use the tournament as a soundbox for their ideas. Since the start of the political crisis, at least 1,000 people have been arrested in anti-government protests. There have been continual calls for strike action, notably in public sector jobs, amid demands for social as well as political change. President Ali Bongo has tried to calm the tensions by promising to open a political dialogue the day after the 2017 African Cup of Nations ends. A big football fan himself, Bongo hopes that the tournament can at least bring a period of calm to his nation.
Selau Neko reporting. Let's now Wanjiku Mwaura for social news.
Yes, indeed. We have discussions on the situation in Gambia. And we have Thomas Mayuga who asks, Dear President of Gambia, Yaya Jammeh, up to now you still haven't given up. Or do you think you would be in power forever?
It's not easy to just give up.
No, but we also have another question. Twaha Mkwajuni Abraham asks, isn't Yaya Jammeh afraid of isolation from other countries? Moody Mabegi says, it's sad that democracy has been jailed in Gambia. The best way to deal with Yaya Jammeh is for the African Union and ECOWAS to impose sanctions on President Jammeh until he hands over leadership to President-elect Adama Barrow.
Well, as we already heard from that interview that I did with Alex Vines, he already doesn't have friends, so I don't think he fears at all because he has nothing to lose, maybe.
And unfortunately. But we move on to Gabon, who are the hosts of the Africa Cup of Nations this year. And the games are set to start on the 14th of January. Honorable Paul Mugume says, apparently, opposition in Gabon is preaching the message of boycott AFCON. How safe will the visitors and fans be amid such tensions? We also have another comment from Rogue, who says, AFCON is around the corner and the excitement of the Gabonese people is zero. People do not seem to care at all.
Well, maybe when we get there, they will begin to care, I suppose.
Maybe. We have a last comment from Tim who says a football fan in who is a football fan in Germany, and he says, all I can ask is for Aubameyang to come back with AFCON. I will be purchasing a Gabon shirt.
I hope he does do.
This is DW Africa Link from Bonn, Germany, with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And Wanjiko Maura.
Still to come, the love for artificial hair. Nothing can separate Zambian women from their wigs. But what do the men say?
When you use weaves, I believe you're losing your sense of originality.
We also have more on social media, so keep commenting on the Facebook page, DW Africa.
But first, we go to Cameroon. Now, they always say the coin has two sides. Depending on which side you look at, it may appear better than the other, but the choice is yours. In eastern Cameroon, Chinese companies have intensified mining, and the youths who previously had nothing now earn up to $30 a day. The result? Children as young as 7 years are dropping out of school for a quick catch. As Moki Kinseka reports, the working conditions and the impact on the environment are not pleasant.
I am driving smoothly on a tarred road to Betari Oya. 5 years ago, access to this eastern Cameroon town was very difficult through bumpy and narrow roads. Simon Estil, the highest government official in the area, says development is being brought about by the extraction of gold.
When we just arrived here, there was only one weekly market. Today, it is a daily market and there's already a second market. All houses are now being constructed with modern material. 5 years ago, young traders came here to sell fuel in cans, but today we already have 4 fuel stations, even though mining is still at an artisan stage. That is enough to make you understand how gold mining can transform a locality. At gold mines barely 25 kilometers from the city center, I met groups of youths digging for gold. Among them is 30-year-old Aman Zibi.
We come to the gold mines at 6 a.m. and return at 6 or 7 p.m. Honestly speaking, we are happy. Many traders are coming here. Thieves who were harassing people in the town are coming here to work, and robbery has drastically reduced. However, when there are problems between workers, I am called upon to intervene, and that's how we live in peace here.
Armand says each of the youths makes an average of $30 per day, money which is influencing life patterns here at Betari Oya. But the lucrative gold mining business has not only attracted the youth from neighboring villages, but also children, young as 11, who are dropping out of school at an alarming rate and heading for the mines. 17-year-old Magbra Oya left primary school when he was only 12 and headed for the gold mines.
My family had practically nothing to live on or to eat. When you see this huge number leaving, it is because they have discovered what is under the soil and can now raise their heads.
Alluvial gold mining began in Betari Oya in 2007 and was basically carried out in an archaic manner by local miners. 3 years later, the Chinese arrived to carry out the mining with modern equipment. Adamu Iya Justin, mayor of Betari Oya, says his locality has not benefited from the lucrative gold mines in his area of jurisdiction.
Since I became mayor of Betari Oya, I've never had any taxes from mining exploitation. There was an agreement to pay some mining royalties to the population, and a management committee was created. It's been dissolved, and nothing is paid to the population.
A report by Moki Kinseka.
Use on.
Black hair care has become a multi-billion dollar industry, with ladies spending considerable amounts of money on purchasing and maintaining weaves and their extensions. In Zambia, weaves are so common among women that you hardly see their natural hair. Crispin Mwakdeo has this report, presented by Zipora Njeri.
This may sound like a DJ entertaining music lovers, but don't be fooled. The music and the voice are coming from a store located in Zambia's central business district in the capital, Lusaka. The shop sells nothing but weave and hair extensions. On this day, they are promoting some of their products. Women and girls flock to the stall, hoping to get a good bargain. Chilufia Chinsese is one of them.
Why Zambian women love those things is because we've got stubborn hair. So when you put those things, it actually becomes better to maintain, unlike using just your own hair. When you compare maybe to, say, Brazilians, they've got hair that's easy to grow and they've got the products, the right products to use for that.
The Brazilian hair extensions that Chinsese is talking about can cost up to $500. That is almost 5,000 Zambian kwacha, a lot of money to wear around your head. Kaniki Priscilla, a university student, reveals how much money she spends per month to maintain her weave.
About 300? Yeah, 300 kwacha, Zambian kwacha.
300 Zambian kwacha is approximately $30. Not a small amount for a college student. According to the market research firm Mintel, the black hair care industry is potentially worth $500 billion. That is more than twice Greece's gross domestic product. Esnat Banda is trading in weaves and extensions in Lusaka. She says things couldn't be any better.
Zambian ladies can't do without weaves. It has become so common that you cannot even go a day or two without putting weave. So it's a good business actually now.
Good business for those who sell the weaves. Although a minority, some women do prefer to wear their natural hair, like Precious Kaniki, another university student in Lusaka. She's among the few who prefer to have their own hair.
I think I love my natural me. So it's easy for me to maintain my hair because I just have to bath, put some Vaseline, and it looks nice.
Okay, a bit confusing. Both the women who wear weaves and those who have natural hair say it's easy to maintain and looks good. What do Zambian men make of that?
When you use weaves, I believe you're losing your sense of originality. You know, as far as some people suffer from hair loss, those are an exception. But for others that actually do have hair, why would you choose to use something that's artificial?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with putting on weaves and extensions. Well, obviously, you know, some of them might overdo it or, you know, personally, I don't find anything wrong with that. I mean, if it makes them look good, if it makes them feel good or look presentable, there's nothing wrong with that.
Listen, natural is natural, artificial is artificial, but if a girl love that, better do that. Why I say?
Opinions may vary, but one thing is certain. Nothing comes between a Zambian woman and her weave.
A report by Crispin Mwakdeo.
Speaking out.
In Uganda, a soldier has dragged the country's army to court, accusing them of torturing him. Corporal Majibu Sebulia was deployed on a peacekeeping mission in Somalia. He was arrested for allegedly stealing ammunition. Sebulia's case, among others, highlights stories of human rights abuses leveled against the Ugandan army forces in the past. It has also been accused of running the so-called safe houses, which instead it uses to torture suspects, an accusation that the government denies. Alex Jita with the details.
Heavy bags were tied around his genitals during interrogation. Corporal Majibu Sebiara has told the Ugandan court He had spent several months in prison after being tried and convicted by the army judicial system for allegedly stealing ammunition during a peacekeeping mission in Somalia. Sebiala later reached out to the civil courts and reported a torture case. If he wins his case, the testimony extracted from him through torture cannot be used as evidence. As the case is still ongoing, Sebiala's lawyers were ordered not to comment about the case. But the army spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Pade Yankunda, said they are carrying out investigations of their own to verify his claims.
We will be finding out allegations of torture, which the officer has claimed, and also ensuring that we investigate this matter to the letter and leave no stone unturned. If there was anybody who could have engaged in torture of this officer, they will be taken on under our law.
Meanwhile, amidst all this, the army and the police are also facing another torture case in court, this time involving suspected terrorists who were arrested together with the king of the small Rwenzururu kingdom in western Uganda. The king, Wesley Mumbele, was arrested on murder charges together with 139 of his guards. The guards are accused of being part of the group accused of killing policemen and burning up police posts in western Uganda. The lawyer representing the guards in court, Caleb Alaka, accused Brigadier Peter Ereru, the commander of the unit that attacked the palace, of personally overseeing their interrogation.
Culprits or the perpetrators should be brought and be charged in court. And of course, the chief suspect is Brigadier Ereru. He oversaw the torture of these people. Actually, he's a criminal.
According to official sources, over 70 people were killed in the fire exchange between the police, the Ugandan army, and the guards. The leaders in the area, however, claimed that the people were unarmed and that the army had gone on a killing spree. Brigadier Ereru denies this.
We had to storm the palace and get these terrorists, and that is what we did. In the process, we realized that they were armed. They fired at our soldiers. They were using small arms and these improvised explosive devices. And some of those things have been recovered by the police.
Members of parliament from the area reached out to the International Criminal Court, which also responded saying the request will be handled appropriately. The request from the area members of parliament is to have the ICC investigate the killings. Winnie Kiza is one of them.
If, for example, we decided to take them to the Ugandan court, will it really give us justice? We are saying it is government that killed people. Then we wouldn't have taken these people to the same government for arbitration. That's why we are calling for a neutral party, the ICC, to come and look into these issues. We believe there is a case of violation of human rights. We believe there is a crimes against humanity, and possibly find the perpetrators culpable to also answer their charges.
Other bodies, including religious leaders, have also called for independent bodies to investigate exactly what happened.
Alex Gita in Kampala. Wanjiku, take her through the social news.
Indeed, lots of your comments on the Zambian women and hair extensions.
That's a topic that attracts lots of comments, I know.
Yes, Swa Willie Kevin says the high quality and stylish ones, consistent with their head shape, accentuates their good looks. The trend is now gravitating towards short natural hair. It also makes them look stylish. It's all about one's taste. We have Isaac Ehoso Godwin who says, I love ladies with healthy natural hair. However, some ladies don't know how to treat their hair, so they use weave cap or sew it in their hair. Dick Msiska says the influence of Western looking flowing hair on the perception of poor Zambian women is mental colonization. This is not different from women using bleaching agents.
Bleaching agents, that's another topic that attracts lots of controversy.
Absolutely. Emeline Chimuka Namwida says in Zambia, 9 out of 10 of our women have got hair extensions. They really run away from the beauty of being a black African. Western culture has destroyed the beauty of Africans. We also have Will Kapita who writes in and says, they don't even look good though, and half their looks is all fake. Well, that's Will Kapita's opinion right there.
Yeah.
But we have more. Simeon W. Butenge says they don't take pride in themselves for being African queens due to contemporary colonialism. Well, Lindsay Kukunda says it's pure mental colonization. But we have one Chipo Kulwe who says, I love my natural hair, no wigs. That's just like you, Ayeko.
Indeed, that's the African in me. And on that note, we have to leave it there. Wanjiku, thank you so much for tuning on to Africa Link. I'm Jane Ayeko.
I'm Wanjiku Mwaura.